Hello, this podcast is part of the Argekunz public program Soil Times for 2021, curated by BAU. The present series is titled Reading Rivers, an ongoing reading group that expands on the exhibitions and artistic practices shown at Argekunz. You will now listen to selected texts discussed during the reading group. The texts relate to the exhibition program and are read through the lens of soil and its relationship to human life.
Nick Axel, Cooking Sections, and Nicholas Hirsch, Exhausted in Efflux Architecture, April 2021. Over millennia, human productivity has been strongly tied to the ability to reproduce, working the land while raising children. Productivity and reproduction had to grow hand in hand with forced agricultural or later industrial work. While extractive practices are one of the main drivers to the unprecedented environmental transformation of the planet, most evident in climate change, biodiversity loss, and the emission of greenhouse gases, the bodies that inhabit it and its soils are also becoming infertile. Globally, men's fertility rates are falling 1.4% on average every year. Once part of the so-called Fertile Crescent, Turkey has positioned itself as a world-leading destination for reproductive tourism. Istanbul has become a booming hub for IVF and other assisted reproductive technologies, ARTs. Over the last two decades, reproductive clinics in the country have doubled, placing Turkey as one of the leading destinations for ARTs in the Middle East and beyond. Once perceived as the birthplace of agriculture and sedentary societies, even the Fertile Crescent has become less and less fertile. Since the Neolithic era, the visual representation of fertile bodies and fertile soil has been inseparable, with one giving meaning to the other as entangled forms of life. The transition from nomadic hunter-gathering to agriculture is conventionally described as a linear episode of human development. But archaeological evidence of ancient settlements in Anatolia and the Caucasian steppes perhaps demonstrates the opposite. Neolithic farming communities, especially in the so-called Fertile Crescent, a term coined in 1914 by U.S. Orientalist archaeologist James Henry Breasted, quickly expanded and spread to alluvial bottomlands at the expense of non-sedentary inhabitants. In virtually all early agricultural settings, the superiority of farming over non-sedentary peoples was underwritten by an elaborate mythology recounting how a powerful god or goddess entrusted the sacred grain to a chosen people. These beliefs were represented in ceramic figurines, everyday artifacts that have been misinterpreted by archaeologists as vehicles to link the veneration of fertility mother goddesses and fruitful lands with virility, femininity, and abundance. In the excavation site of Çatalhöyük in Anatolia, for instance, which at the time of its discovery in the late 1950s was the oldest city ever known, figurines were initially thought to be mother goddesses. Recent work has dismantled the theory of these figurines as reproductive bodies associated with fertility, instead positioning them as earthly, elderly, and powerful women in the gender-equal community whose bodies convey accumulation of wisdom and continued prosperity. And the social structure these figures came from was not based on the nuclear family, but on collective groups that were most likely matrilineal, matrilogical, and matrifocal. Neolithic people in central Anatolia might neither have conceptualized their spiritual world populated by anthropomorphic entities called gods, nor even needed a mother goddess. Millennia later, industrialization demanded a larger population to work, toil, and serve, which in turn required even more fertile ground to feed them. The tremendous effort to industrialize and upscale agriculture during the 20th century to extract higher yield and profit from soils in the guise of feeding the world is profoundly marked by the discovery and manufacture of synthetic ammonia in 1908. Based on the Haber-Bosch method, later upscaled by BASF In Germany, synthetic ammonia gave birth to the international fertilizer trade and ultimately the over-fertilization of soils worldwide. This inaugurated a new era of outlandish amounts of fractured chemicals, nitrogen, potassium, calcium, PCBs, DDTs, and glyphosates, flowing all over the world through the ground, rivers, oceans, human, and more than human bodies. They have eventually become endocrine disruptors affecting sex and reproduction of species along trophic cascades in unprecedented ways. From the Haber-Bosch process to the so-called Green Revolution, billions of people have been fed, while millions have also died in wars derived from food conflicts, starvation, waves of farmer suicides, and a torrent of environmental changes, largely impacted by fertilizer runoff, pesticide contamination, water scarcity, and algal blooms. More than a century after its invention, the overuse of fertilizer has proved to be a major contributor to worldwide soil deterioration through acidification, partly due to side effects of nitrogen, phosphates, and ammonia dependencies. These dependencies are entangled with a series of modern infrastructures, agrochemical facilities, modern wheats, modern pests, genetically modified crops, human-made famines, and agricultural trade fairs. They have also been coupled with heteropatriarchal modern family models to enhance the nation's fertility and are now collapsing under imminent and continuous soil and bodily exhaustion. Rather than humans domesticating grain, it seems all these modern technologies eventually domesticated humans, as bodies more and more struggle to reproduce, should they want to.
Jan Willem Erismann et al. How a Century of Ammonia Synthesis Changed the World. Nature Geoscience 1, number 10, 2008, pages 636 to 639. On 13 October 1908, Fritz Haber filed his patent on the synthesis of ammonia from its elements, for which he was later awarded the 1918 Nobel Prize in Chemistry. 100 years on, we live in a world transformed by and highly dependent upon Haber-Bosch nitrogen. Although over 78% of the atmosphere is composed of nitrogen, it exists in its chemically and biologically unusable gaseous form. Haber discovered how ammonia, a chemically reactive, highly usable form of nitrogen, could be synthesized by reacting atmospheric denitrogen with hydrogen in the presence of iron at high pressures and temperatures. Today, this reaction is known as the Haber-Bosch process. Fritz Haber was the inventor who created the breakthrough and laid the foundations for high-pressure chemical engineering, but it was Carl Bosch who subsequently developed it on an industrial scale, for which he was awarded the Nobel Prize in 1931. The importance of Haber's discovery cannot be overestimated. As a result, millions of people have died in armed conflicts over the past 100 years, but at the same time, billions of people have been fed. In his Nobel lecture, Haber explained that his main motivation for synthesizing ammonia from its elements was the growing demand for food, and the concomitant need to replace the nitrogen lost from fields owing to the harvesting of crops. It was clear that the demand for fixed nitrogen, which at the beginning of the century could be satisfied with a few hundred thousand tons a year, must increase to millions of tons. We know now that his vision was right. The current worldwide use of fertilizer nitrogen is about 100 TG nitrogen per year. Haber's other motivation, not mentioned in his lecture, was to provide the raw material for explosives to be used in weapons, which requires large amounts of reactive nitrogen. Haber's discovery has therefore had a major influence on both world wars and all subsequent conflicts. In addition, the large-scale production of ammonia has facilitated the industrial manufacture of a large number of chemical compounds and many synthetic products. Thus, the Haber-Bosch process, with its impacts on agriculture, industry, and the course of modern history,
has literally changed the world. What Fritz Haber could not foresee, however, was the cascade of environmental changes, including the increase in water and air pollution, the perturbation of greenhouse gas levels, and the loss of biodiversity that was the result from the colossal increase in ammonia production and use that was to ensue. Here we reflect on the influence that Haber's invention has had on society over the last century, both the benefits and unintended consequences. And based on different scenarios of future nitrogen fertilizer use, we discuss some of the challenges likely to be faced by our nitrogen economy in the next 100 years. Fertilizers. At the same time, the Haber-Bosch process has facilitated the production of agricultural fertilizers on an industrial scale, dramatically increasing global agricultural productivity in most regions of the world. We estimate that the number of humans supported per hectare of arable land has increased from 1.9 to 4.3 persons between 1908 and 2008. This increase was mainly possible because of Haber-Bosch nitrogen. Smil estimated that at the end of the 20th century, about 40% of the world's population depended on fertilizer inputs to produce food. It is difficult to quantify this number precisely because of changes in cropping methods, mechanization, plant breeding and genetic modification, and so on. However, an independent analysis based on long-term experiments and national statistics concluded that about 30 to 50% of the crop yield increase was due to nitrogen application through mineral fertilizers. It is important to note that these estimates are based on global averages, which hide major regional differences. In Europe and North America, increases in agriculture productivity have been matched by luxury levels of nitrogen consumption, owing to an increase in the consumption of meat and dairy products, which require more fertilizer nitrogen to produce. This is partly reflected in the global increase in per capita meat consumption. In contrast, the latest Food and Agriculture Organization report shows that approximately 850 million people remain undernourished. Overall, we suggest that nitrogen fertilizer has supported approximately 27% of the world's population over the past century, equivalent to around 4 billion people born, or 42% of the estimated total births, since 1908. For these calculations, we assumed that, in the absence of additional nitrogen, other improvements would have accounted for a 20% increase in productivity between 1950 and 2000. Consistent with Smil, we estimate that by 2000, nitrogen fertilizers were responsible for feeding 44% of the world's population. Our updated estimate for 2008 is 48%. So the lives of around half of humanity are made possible by Haber-Bosch nitrogen. In addition, fertilizer is required for bioenergy and biofuel production. Currently, bioenergy contributes 10% of the global energy requirement, whereas biofuels contribute 1.5%. These energy sources do not therefore have a large influence on global fertilizer use. However, with biofuel production set to increase, the influence of Haber-Bosch nitrogen will only grow. Together with the role of reactive nitrogen in ammunition supplies, these figures provide an illustration of the huge importance of industrial ammonia production for society, although on balance, it remains questionable to what extent the consequences can be considered as beneficial. The next century of Haber-Bosch. We project global nitrogen fertilizer demand over the next century on the basis of the four storylines developed for the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change Special Reports on Emission Scenarios, SRES. The storylines reflect varying economic, demographic, and technological developments. The A1 storyline assumes a world of very rapid economic growth, a global population that peaks mid-century, and rapid introduction of new and more efficient technologies. B1 describes a convergent world with the same global population as A1, but with more rapid changes in economic structures towards a service and information economy. B2 describes a world with intermediate population and economic growth, emphasizing local solutions to economic, social, and environmental sustainability. A2 describes a very heterogeneous world with high population growth, slow economic development, and slow technological change. We consider the following 5 parameters to be the main drivers of the estimated trends in fertilizer use, and we apply a subset of these parameters to the respective scenarios. 1. Population growth is the main driver behind the increase in nitrogen fertilizer use. The SRES population projections range between 7, B1, and 15 billion people, A2, in 2100. Recent research suggests that global fertility rates will continue to decrease. As a consequence, population growth is expected to eventually halt. 2. The potential for increasing yield per hectare is large and could allow food output to keep pace with population increases without requiring an increase in cropping area. At the same time, an increase in fertilizer efficiency is expected. In agreement with Mill, we assume that nitrogen management can be improved, resulting in a 50% increase in nitrogen use efficiency, thus reducing nitrogen application. 3. Further demand in agriculture may be posed by biofuel production, calling for an expansion of cropland as well as an increase in nitrogen demand. In the technology-oriented global scenario A1, we use the Organization for Economic Cooperation Development estimate of the maximum potential land available for bioenergy, 0.74 GHA, which represents an extension equal to half the current cropland area. 4. Large parts of the world population are deprived of valuable animal protein. We assume that food equity will increase worldwide meat consumption to the level observed in developed countries. Increased meat production will increase nitrogen usage because of the additional nitrogen required to produce animal feed and the efficiency of nitrogen use in meat-based diets relative to plant-based diets. 5. We assume that human diets will be optimized to improve nitrogen conversion efficiency in the production cycle. Specifically, we assume that the ratio of meat protein to milk protein, currently about 2 to 1, will be reversed, 1 to 2, as the nitrogen to protein conversion ratio is higher in milk than meat. Our projections are well within the low estimates provided by the Food and Agriculture Organization and some higher estimates in scientific literature, which suggest a 2- to 3-fold increase in nitrogen fertilizer use by the second half of the 21st century, assuming continuation of past practices. In all our scenarios, anticipated improvement in efficiency will compensate for much of the increase in fertilizer demand. Furthermore, we do not expect global protein supply to improve towards food equity in the scenarios predicting high population growth, A2 and B2 projections. Thus, the drivers towards high nitrogen use will not occur simultaneously, leading to smaller differences in annual nitrogen demand, 100 to 150 TGN, than would be expected from population projection alone. Only when bioenergy calls for a large increase in crop production is fertilizer nitrogen demand expected to double to nearly 200 TGN per year. Despite the uncertainty and the many important drivers not included, all scenarios point towards an increase in future production of reactive nitrogen. This will further increase the nitrogen pressures on the environment, with uneven distribution only exacerbating the problem regionally.
An excerpt from Rosie Bradotti, The Post-Human, published by Cambridge Polity Press, pages 47 to 50. An altogether different and powerful source of inspiration for contemporary reconfigurations of critical post-humanism is ecology and environmentalism. They rest on an enlarged sense of interconnection between self and others, including the non-human or earth others. This practice of relating to others requires and is enhanced by the rejection of self-centered individualism. It produces a new way of combining self-interests with the well-being of an enlarged community based on environmental interconnections. Environmental theory stresses the link between the humanistic emphasis on man as a measure of all things and the domination and exploitation of nature, and condemns the abuses of science and technology. Both of them involve epistemic and physical violence over the structural others and are related to the European Enlightenment ideal of reason. The worldview, which equated mastery with rational scientific control over others, also militated against the respect for the diversity of living matters and of human cultures, Mies and Schiever, 1993. The environmental alternative is a new holistic approach that combines cosmology with anthropology and post-secular, mostly feminist spirituality, to assert the need for loving respect for diversity in both its human and non-human forms. Significantly, Schiever and Mies stress the importance of life-sustaining spirituality in this struggle for new concrete forms of universality, a reverence for the sacredness of life, of deeply seated respect for all that lives. This attitude is opposed to Western humanism and to the West's investment in rationality and secularity as the precondition for development through science and technology. In a holistic perspective, they call for the re-enchantment of the world, or for healing of the earth and that which has been so cruelly disconnected. Instead of the emphasis on emancipation from the realm of natural necessity, Schiever pleads for a form of emancipation that occurs within that realm and in harmony with it. From this shift of perspective, there follows a critique of the ideal of equality as the emulation of masculine modes of behaviour, and also the rejection of the model of development that is built upon this ideal and is compatible with worldwide forms of market domination. Although ecological posthumanists like Schiever take great care to distance themselves from anything that is even remotely related to postmodernism, postcolonialism, or postfeminism, paradoxically, they share in the epistemic premises of posthuman critiques. For instance, they agree with the posthuman structuralist generation on the critique of the homogenization of cultures under the effects of globalized advanced capitalism. They propose, as an alternative, a robust type of environmentalism based on non-Western neo-humanism. What matters for Mies and Schiever is the reassertion of the need for new universal values in the sense of interconnectedness among humans on a worldwide scale. Thus, universal needs are amalgamated to universal rights, and they cover as much basic and concrete necessities, such as food, shelter, health, safety, as higher cultural needs like education, identity, dignity, knowledge, affection, joy, and care. These constitute the material grounding of the situated claims to new ethical values. A new ecological post-human thus raises issues of power and entitlement in the age of globalization and calls for self-reflexivity on the part of the subjects who occupy the former humanist center, but also those who dwell in one of the many scattered centers of power of advanced postmodernity, taken from Grieval and Kaplan, 1994. In my own work, I define the critical post-human subject with an eco-philosophy of multiple belongings. As a relational subject constituted in and by multiplicity, that is to say, a subject that works across differences and is also internally differentiated, but still grounded and accountable. Post-human subjectivity expresses an embodied and embedded, and hence partial form of accountability, based on a strong sense of collectivity, relationality, and hence community building. My position is in favour of complexity and promotes radical post-human subjectivity, resting on the ethics of becoming, as we shall see in the next chapter. The focus is shifted accordingly from unitary to nomadic subjectivity, thus running against the grain of high humanism and its contemporary variations. This view rejects individualism, but also asserts an equally strong distance from relativism or nihilistic defeatism. It promotes an ethical bond of an altogether different sort from the self-interest of an individual subject, as defined along the canonical lines of classical humanism. A post-human ethics for a non-unitary subject proposes an enlarged sense of interconnection between self and others, including the non-human or earth others, by removing the obstacle of self-centered individualism. As we saw earlier, contemporary biogenetic capitalism generates a global form of reactive mutual interdependence of all living organisms, including non-humans. This form of unity tends to be of the negative kind, as a shared form of vulnerability, that is to say, a global sense of interconnection between the human and the non-human environment in the face of common threats. The post-human recomposition of human interaction that I propose is not the same as the reactive bond of vulnerability, but is an affirmative bond that locates the subject in the flow of relations with multiple others. As we shall see in the next chapter, for me, there is a necessary link between critical post-humanism and the move beyond anthropocentrism. I refer to this move as expanding the notion of life towards the non-human or Zoe. This results in a radical post-humanism as a position that transposes hybridity, nomadism, diasporas, and creolization processes into a means of regrounding claims to subjectivity, connections, and community among subjects of the human and the non-human kind.